retrievers watching their masters dine. Bright young people streamed out of Netscape and Silicon Graphics and a lot of other companies begging for Clark's help. Clark's enthusiasm for his calling was almost viral. Young people didn't need his money. They could get money from venture capitalists. They needed his imprimatur on their new ideas. Some of them didn't even have an idea, just an idea that they might like to have an idea. All of these budding entrepreneurs wanted to be around Clark. In the same way, normal people wanted to be around at sunrise, just to see where the light came from. They wanted to see Clark stand up and say, "Behold, the new thing." The whole situation was preposterous, or would have been at any other time and any other place. But as Clark himself realized, a number of things had changed that made his approach to business and to life viable. The first and most obvious change was the miracle in the U.S. stock market. From the launching of Netscape to the launching of Hyperion, the Dow Jones Industrial Average ran up more than 5,000 points. More to the point, the NASDAQ stock exchange that listed most new technology companies quadrupled. The market paid people a great deal of money for technology companies that made only losses. The American public decided that it was willing to take a flying leap into the future, which is to say, it was willing to take a flying leap on whatever Jim Clark and entrepreneurs like him were willing to take a flying leap on, at 10 times the price. The second thing pushing Clark on was the nature of the software business. Netscape and the companies that followed it were different in important ways from Silicon Graphics. The most important difference, at least from the financial point of view of those who dreamed up the companies, was that they cost almost nothing to start. All you needed was an idea, some excellent engineering talent, and a pair of big brass balls to execute that idea. You didn't need to raise millions to build your product, and in the process whittle your stake down to almost nothing. You found the concept, you wrote the software to exploit the concept, you sold the company to the public. All of this caused, and was in turn caused by, a subtle but important shift in the Silicon Valley value system, and that was the last reason Jim Clark was the man of this particular moment.
"Silicon Valley has more in common with Hollywood than it does with Detroit," said Vern Anderson, the first CEO of Silicon Graphics, and thus the first captain of the first ship built by Jim Clark. "The venture capitalists are the studios, the managers are the directors, the ordinary engineers are the writers, and the entrepreneurs are the stars."
What happened in Silicon Valley is a lot like what happened in Hollywood once the studios lost their clout. The stars seized power. And once they'd seized power, they raised their price and demanded the right to direct their own pictures. And very great stars like Jim Clark cut deals worthy of Marlon Brando. They showed up on the set for a few days, then strolled away with half the budget. And so, even after he'd drawn the magic diamond, Clark groped on. For a couple of months, during the summer of 1998, there was a fellow named Greg Kovacs, whom Clark had somehow gotten to know at the Center for Integrated Systems at Stanford University. Clark had walked into Kovacs's lab, peered into a microscope, and found himself staring at what appeared to be an ordinary computer chip. The chip began to pulse, as if it had a heartbeat. Kovacs had grafted the cells from the heart of a chicken onto a chip. The egg cartons were piled up behind Kovacs's door, as if to prove it. The electrical impulses of the cell spoke to the chip. The chip was alive. For maybe 8 weeks, the idea of a living computer chip had Clark's mind racing down its long, dark tunnel. Kovacs already had a deal with the Defense Department, which thought the chip might come in handy in biological wars. Clark thought about other applications. Actually, he thought back to his graduate work at the University of Utah, where he had become fascinated with the idea of recording the electrical impulses in the brain and creating a kind of library of thoughts and sensations. If you could graft a cell onto a chip, you could graft a chip onto a cell.
"I'm sure in some way the neurosystem will one day be integrated with the computer," said Clark. "Wouldn't it be great if you could neurally integrate, say, the number 500342?
Chips could be planted inside the human body. Clark went to his friend, John Hennessy, the dean of electrical engineering at Stanford, and offered to pay for a new field of study, which he wanted to call biocomputing. Then one day, Greg Kovacs disappeared, and Clark never mentioned him again. In place of Kovacs came a steady stream of young people, toting their inventions and ideas. There was FM and AM radio on the web. There was local news on the web. There were the countless fruits of the Human Genome Project. It wasn't uncommon to find Jim Clark talking to someone with a glass of wine in one hand and a petri dish in the other. They came to his house. They came to his office. But if they were smart, they came to the boat.
The boat was where all serious gestation occurred. The boat was where he kept his mind alive to the possibilities. Hyperion was not merely a technologist's utopia and a budding new thing. It was both of those things. It was also a place where Clark could remain apart from the environment he was continually reinventing. He could never become one of those ordinary people, a venture capitalist or a chief executive or a member of a museum board or anything else that required him to behave in the way important businessmen are meant to behave. Circumstance had made him an insider, but temperament kept him forever an outsider. He was like the man who threw the world's biggest bash and failed to show up for it. This outsiderliness was what gave him his unusual view of the world. His talent for groping the future was generally viewed as a supernatural gift, but it was as much a matter of his limitations as his strengths. He could see human society in ways that most businessmen could not, because he was not very much a part of it. And consciously or not, by retiring to his floating island, he preserved this precious limitation. The next time he and some new technology entered the larger society, he would be on his boat. He did not walk, but sail into other people's lives. Chapter 9. The Home of the Future? And so to the boat we went, at least until the time came for the new thing. What links Clark maintained from there to the world outside ran through 24 computers manufactured by Silicon Graphics and an internet browser created by Netscape.
"There is nothing more satisfying to me," he said, "than to create a complete self-contained world when a computer is controlling it."
It took a while before anyone saw the full implications of that statement, especially for the less technical people who lived in that self-contained world. The first inkling came just after the tumultuous trial in the North Sea. By the end of December 1998, the damage caused to Hyperion during its trial in the North Sea had been repaired, and the crew and the computer programmers moved on board and prepared for the Atlantic crossing. Soon enough, it became clear to them that if you lived on board, either you programmed the computer or you were programmed by it. Either you were Steve and Lance and Tim, or you were not. Steve and Lance and Tim each had, at one time or another, worked for Silicon Graphics. They had quit whatever they were doing to be involved in whatever Jim Clark was up to. Clark called his new enterprise Seascape. By the time of the sea trials, the Seascape programmers had spent more than 2 years cobbling together the code required to control a sailboat. Right from the start, they'd assumed that Clark wouldn't bother to yoke his yacht to a computer unless there was money to be made from it. They had no real reason to think this except that Clark was incapable of creating new technology without finding a way to make money from it. Any one of them could easily have found jobs and stock options with Yahoo or Cisco or even Microsoft. Yet they preferred to toil in relative commercial obscurity, building a system that any intelligent, uninformed person, that is, anyone who did not know Clark, would view as a rich man's folly. To them, Clark's commercial life was a magic act. Oddly enough, by December 1998, and before the software had even been tested, the programmers' instincts were looking less like blind faith and more like prescience. One of Clark's business ideas had them excited. The boat's software could be adapted to the home. The American home of the future, it went without saying, would be controlled and monitored by a computer. The computer would permit the owner to enter into a new fantastic relationship with his dwelling. Indeed, one way of viewing Hyperion was as a test of the technology. Clark had served up his sailboat's captain and six-person crew as guinea pigs. They would see how life would be in a computerized home. By the end of 1998, Steve Haig, whom Clark had designated Seascape's programmer-in-chief, was trading emails with corporate executives and venture capitalists who might become involved, then passing on the results of his discussions, also via email, to Lance and Tim. The general idea was to sell their software first to rich technophiles and then gradually infiltrate the minds of the middle-class owners of suburban tract houses. In one of his messages written about the time Hyperion left its dock, Steve informed his fellow programmers of a big-time CEO who might want to help to create, as Steve put it, "a package which he can sell as part of a big custom installation to the Larry Ellisons of the world, that is, rich technologists. Ultimately, I think this technology could be sold as more of a standard product, maybe via franchises. One interesting example was big vacation homes in Hawaii, where the owners would like to log into the house over the web and see if the pool's warm and the cleaners are not fucking in the master bed." No doubt the home of the future was only one of several possible uses Clark would find for their work.
That was Clark's job, to imagine a future for their software. How he did this, Lance and Tim and Steve could not have cared less. Like a lot of the smart engineers in Silicon Valley, they had given up trying to figure out how Clark's mind worked. And so they wrote the code to control Clark's boat and waited to find out what Clark's next trick might be. Mainly, they tried to ensure that the first home of the future did not wind up on the ocean floor. They set up their machines on a long grade school cafeteria table in Hyperion's main salon. Everyone else working on the boat, and along with the 8 full-time crew, there were still dozens of boatyard workers, swirled around them. In context, the computer programmers appeared idle. They sat quietly, stared into their screens, and sipped cappuccinos. And yet, they were by far the most important people on board Hyperion. Steve Haig was the project manager, which is to say that he was supposed to stitch the patches of computer code written by different people at a furious speed into a perfect, seamless quilt. Many of the biggest patches were written by Clark himself, of course. This put Steve in the delicate position of supervising his boss. He acquired, as a result, a superhuman ability to sit still and be hollered at. His life had prepared him for the job. Raised in a working-class family in Leeds, a dreary city in the north of England, he had emerged with one of those wry, self-effacing personalities that has existed in England at least since Shakespeare wrote his comic relief. Steve was Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, and Bardolph and Pym, rolled into one. When he claimed that his childhood had been so dull that he didn't recall anything of it except that a cat died once, he was so perfectly droll that you didn't stop and think about what that meant. Although Steve's skill with computers had been his ticket out of Leeds to Silicon Valley, he regarded the machine as, at best, an unsteady ally. It was always laying traps for the programmer. He thought of the computer as a less than straightforward tool for controlling and manipulating the world around it, like a shovel with a loose blade. He had little patience for the mystical, spiritual approach of computer programming, which is to say that his patience often was tried by Lance. Lance was Lance Welsh, who, in the days leading up to the ocean crossing, sat beside Steve at the long cafeteria table in the boat's main living room. Together with Steve and Jim Clark, he wrote the parts of the computer program you could see and touch. Typically, when Lance set out to write a piece of code, he started with a complicated solution and made it even more complicated. Sometimes it worked, other times it didn't, but in every case, no one else could figure out how Lance did what he had done. Lance was to computer programming what Joyce was to literature, possibly profound, but also baffling. The trouble was that clarity and simplicity were more important in computer language than human language. A programmer brought in from the outside to fix a bug in the code needed to determine quickly how it worked. With Lance's code, this was impossible. When something went wrong in it, which it often did, there were only two things that could be done. Either Lance had to go in and fix it himself, or someone had to start from the beginning and rewrite the program. Lance was, in a word, a romantic. The nostalgia the romantic feels for the past Lance felt for the code he had written. For instance, editing computer code, like editing written English, often requires the programmer to remove extraneous lines. Lance refused to do this. Instead, he instructed the computer to preserve his old lines of code. When he came upon a passage that needed deleting, he wrote, number IFDEF, then his old code, then number ENDIF. The computer took this to mean, ignore the old lines of code, but preserve them. In this way, a lot of useless code written by Lance was entombed in Hyperion's computers. This attempt at preservation was only mildly irritating to Steve. It drove Clark wild. Whenever Clark ran across one of these tiny electronic mummies, he'd redden and squinch up like the mouth of Mount Etna before an eruption. Then he set about deleting everything Lance had done. Lance often became upset and complained to Steve that Jim has no feeling for the code. It didn't help Lance's political situation that he was handsome, and not just a little handsome. He was the last of the Mohicans handsome, all long, dark hair and smoky features. Those assigned to open up Lance's code and find a bug often assumed that Lance, at that very tedious moment, was out somewhere being chased by packs of randy women. Lance had the aura of a man who spent a lot of time being chased by packs of randy women. Lance has some strange effect on females, Steve explained. Since I started on this project, I've had more of my female friends ask me whether he was married than ask me whether Jim was married.
Every man who worked with Land suspected that there must be some connection between his excessively romantic attitude toward computer programming and his appeal to women. Lance might not be proof that a male computer programmer, to be desirable to women, had to completely overhaul his attitude towards his machine, but he was terrifyingly suggestive evidence. Tim Powell was the third man on the Hyperion job. He was built like a football tackle and thought of himself as the programming equivalent of one. If you asked Tim which part of the software he was responsible for, he would look away and blush. If you pressed the point, he would say, "If I do my job well, you'll never know about it." Possibly he had seen enough of the ongoing struggle between Jim and Steve and Lance to know he wanted no part of it. In any event, Tim lay low and worked hard and said little. Tim was the only reason I had to suspect that Hyperion would not wind up on the bottom of the ocean floor. Steve and Lance and Tim and Jim. Jim and Tim and Lance and Steve. They had spent 2 years bouncing back and forth between Walter Hausman's boatyard and the single stultifying room on top of a Jenny Craig weight loss center. Now, on a dock outside of Amsterdam, they sat center stage. With every stroke of their keyboards, they hacked a path through the forest that others would be required to follow. The computer programmer creates the only path available to the computer user. The effect of his decisions on others is masked by their abstraction. When you use Microsoft Word, for example, you enter a tiny mental space created by thousands of Microsoft programmers. In the case of software that controls the physical world, rather than merely a symbolic world, this path is less trivial. The programmers decided the steps everyone on board Hyperion would need to take to do everything from dimming the lights to raising the sails. In a thousand subtle and unsubtle ways, they were reinventing the experience of living on board a boat. This late afternoon in December 1998 was one of the last the three young programmers had before Hyperion left its dock and headed out across the Atlantic. None of the young men spoke. Presumably, each was absorbed in his own little chain of logic, though you could never be sure. Then, all hell broke loose. It began with a problem posed by Lance's computer. Somewhere on the boat, an alarm went off, and the words, "Error message," appeared on Lance's screen. Lance shook his dark mane, sipped his cappuccino, and pretended not to notice. The boat was equipped with more than 3,000 alarms. All were capable, in theory, of shouting insults at the captain, but normally they just made an annoying, high-pitched beep-beep-beep sound. At this stage of the work, alarms rang constantly. You could hardly grab a beer from the fridge without triggering a red alert. Lance pointed to the message on his screen and said, "The computer has no sense of proportion. It doesn't know whether what happened is serious or trivial. He got used to ignoring these alarm messages." "Hey! Hey! 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 Hey!" This time the alarm came from a human being. Screams. They came from the galley. "Hey! Hey! 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 Hey!" It was a high-pitched protest, and it was followed immediately by the sound of dishes crashing onto the floor. The computer programmers swiveled in their chairs. Before them unfolded a puzzling scene. A thick slice out of the middle of the table that separated the galley from the lower salon rose up into the air as if by magic. A partition had been built into the table between the galley and the rest of the boat. Like everything else in the boat, it was automated. Tina, Hyperion chef, was throwing her slight frame across the rising slice of wood in a futile bid to hold it in place. The dishes stacked on the table flew in 8 directions. The whole thing was as inevitable as an execution. Steve and Lance and Tim watched as the partition rose and the dishes crashed, and the cook in the galley slowly vanished. As she disappeared behind the partition, Tina's screams became muffled, then silent.
"What the hell caused that?"
asked Steve.
"I didn't do anything," said Tim.
"Who hit what?" asked Steve.
"I was working on the DVD player just before it happened," says Lance. "Maybe that did it."
The three young men in T-shirts and blue jeans shared a chuckle. The DVD player was Hyperion's movie system. Like everything else on board, it was controlled through the computers. In suggesting that the computer code for the movies caused Tina's table to rise up into the ceiling and send dishes flying, Lance had made a joke.
Computer humor.
They quickly forgot the incident. They became lost once again in their sea-blue screens. Now, as they typed, they also spoke.
"The great thing about this project," said Tim,
is that it's software that talks to physical things rather than software that just talks to other software. You can see the effect of what you are doing. Lance disagreed. He thought Tim's need to see his work manifested in the physical world outside the computer betrayed a weakness of spirit.
Real nerds, Lance said, get just as excited when they're talking to other software.
Jim doesn't, said Steve.
Jim is juiced about other things, said Lance. He can now be master of his own domain by virtue of his expertise in computers. He can kick back and enjoy his burgundy while the computer controls the wind and the sails.
You'd like it too, said Steve.
I'm embarrassed to admit it, said Lance. It juices me too, but here's the thing. Jim doesn't give a shit about the technology.
Steve looked up, dubious.
No, really, said Lance. In the beginning, I remember I asked Jim about doing all the screens in 3D. He said, fuck 3D. I said, Jim, you invented 3D.
Hey!
This time, Tina's screams came more shrilly. Down in the galley, Tina's table was now falling as mysteriously as it had risen. As it did this, it created something like a B-movie earthquake effect, sucking anything that wasn't nailed down into its new fissure. Tina fought to rescue a towel from vanishing into the inner earth. The three programmers watched her struggle a bit more contemplatively, then returned to their screens. They were thinking, computer thoughts. Finally, Steve rose very casually and walked down three steps into the lower salon and down another three steps into the galley. He lingered beside the light switch that Jim Clark often used to illustrate the main point about the marvelous flexibility of computers. At the end of a long day of programming, with a glass of fine burgundy in his hand, Clark would flick the light switch on and off and say,
"This switch sends a signal to the computer to turn the lights on and off, but I could just as easily program this switch to turn the engine on or to raise the sails. If I wanted to control the boat from right here, I could."
Steve now stood facing one of the boat's 25 computer screens. The ubiquitous flat panel displays gave the yacht the feel of the ATM wing of a shiny new bank. Everywhere you turned, another ATM machine. Steve poked at the kitchen screen delicately, like a new account holder making his first withdrawal, and then, apparently satisfied, returned to the main salon and his seat in front of his computer. He punched a few more keys. Then he shouted, almost triumphantly,
"Lance, that was you who caused that problem!"
Lance looked up. Tim trotted around to their side of the cafeteria table. On Steve's sea-blue computer screen, a single line of code flashed. It would have been perfectly meaningless to everyone else on the boat, but to these three young men it was an important message. It said, HYP-24, request PLC, write P-24, dash control, S430303-10, 1, colon, parenthesis, 0, parenthesis, colon, null. HYP-24 referred to the 24th computer in the long row of Silicon Graphics machines down below. HYP-24 also happened to be the machine on which Lance was working. The rest of the line consisted of a command issued by computer number 24 to another lower-level computer called a PLC that controlled the sensor that caused Tina's table to rise and fall. That was one way to understand Hyperion, as a network of sensors that spoke to each other. Someone had pressed a button that sent an electrical signal along the wires to the 24th in a long row of computers down below, which had generated an electrical signal that ran back up to Tina's table. Whatever Lance had been doing to the movie system appeared to be the culprit. While obviously not critical in itself, the boat could sail without movies, the message suggested a deeper and more troubling problem. The problem was, why had Lance's computer issued this command? And if Lance could hit a button and send Tina's table into the ceiling, what else might Lance be able to do to the boat simply by hitting a button? No one dared say this, however. They operated on the assumption that the computers inevitably would come through in the clutch.
"What's going on with the partition?" Tina asked.
A sign on the wall of her galley hinted at her exasperation with the home of the future. It read, "Smart people spend hours learning to use new technology. Smarter people find ways to weasel out of it." The three young men remained lost in their computer thoughts. They were all nice young men. They did not wish Tina harm, but the only way they knew to help was through their machines. They failed to respond to the cry from below.
"I don't know," said Tina. "Maybe I'm just along for the ride here."
The three young men dithered over a single computer until a rude new clumping sound interrupted their meditations. Alan Pryor was making his way down the stairs to see what on earth the shouting was about. The captain knew just enough to be worried. He said,
"I heard Lance and problem in the same sentence."
Chapter 10. God Mode. Alan Pryor was a sailor, if such a thing can be said to exist, on a 157-foot yacht decorated with $30 million of French Impressionist paintings and run by a computer. He had finished the Whitbread Round the World Sailboat Race 3 times and had won it once. The Whitbread Race is one of those rites of passage like swimming the English Channel or eating 120 cream donuts at a sitting that indicates a man's willingness to suffer for his art. Back in New Zealand, where Alan grew up, the Whitbread Race is a national obsession. In the late 1970s, a psychiatrist at the University of Auckland had made a study of the strange desire of young New Zealand men to leap into small boats with 7 friends, a few sacks of powdered food, and a commitment not to bathe or shave or wipe or sleep for 6 weeks at a stretch. The psychiatrist evidently decided that the thing had to be seen to be believed, and so made a documentary film of his study. He called his film No Use Calling Home to Mum. When No Use Calling Home to Mum made its debut on New Zealand television, the station switchboard received so many protests that they never again aired the film. To this day, if you want to watch it, you have to purchase a Same as Dad copy for $500. No Use Calling Home to Mum was distinguished from other disturbing television programs by its absolute lack of the usual offensive material. The film contained no sex, no nudity, no blasphemy. It advanced no political or religious heresy. It was perhaps the only film ever made to give offense solely through its main character's grotesque violations of ordinary standards of personal cleanliness. For 30 days at a stretch, the only swipes the young New Zealand sailors made at personal hygiene were from a box of handy wipes. When those 30 days were distilled down to an hour and a half of television, the brave young sailors of New Zealand turned their nation's stomach. Alan Pryor had been one of those brave young sailors. The idea of it still pleased him. He was now in his mid-40s, but an odd smile still played across his face whenever he recalled the nauseating details of his youth. He was, in many ways, still living the life of a Whitbread round-the-world sailor. He rarely bathed. He never changed. He attacked his food with an artless violence that impressed his shipmates so deeply they would relive their last meal with him in the way people do who have just witnessed a traffic accident together. Once during dinner, the crew had watched their new captain reach up into his wiry salt and pepper hair, pluck loose some strange particle, and eat it. He had made a deep impression on them. However damning No Use Calling Home to Mum might have been, it clearly did not begin to explore their captain's ability to do things which, if captured on film and broadcast on television, might inspire large numbers of people to call in to complain. Still, Alan enjoyed a serious reputation in sailing circles. He was, in fact, a gifted sailor. He had instincts and experience no computer could match, at least not yet. He was Kasparov in the early days of fighting Deep Blue. At least one of the crew members of Hyperion referred to him without irony as the legend. Alan had been slow to assimilate the computer. In his mind's eye, when Alan envisioned a sailboat, he still saw a shell outfitted with a sail and 8 kiwis with skin-like leather, and no real conviction about personal hygiene. A computer had no place in this picture. In the beginning, he treated the new technology as a stowaway.
"I think he hated us," Steve said.
But over time, the programmers, with the owner behind them, came to terms with the captain, or felt they had.
"Alan has, in a sense, been broken," Lance said. "He's seen what a disastrous state the software was in and can be in. And so, when it does work, even a little, he's happy."
That was debatable. Over the past year and a half, as the boat was being built, Alan had developed a hard crust of cynicism about the boys from Silicon Valley. When Jim Clark was around, he did a fair job of disguising his true feelings, but when Clark was nowhere in sight, Alan did not deny himself his bit of fun at the expense of the techno-geeks hired by Clark to turn his boat into a computer. He'd creep up behind them as they hunched over their terminals and whisper little menacing thoughts into their delicate ears.
"During the America's Cup trials," he'd say, "we had a separate boat for the computer room. 12 computer nerds throwing up on the keyboards. They were supposed to tell us how we could go faster."
He'd pause for effect.
but it's a bit of a problem doing anything on a computer when you get the diced carrot stuck behind the A key.
It didn't take a psychiatrist to see that Alan would have been just as happy setting off in one of those wooden boats built by Walter's grandfather. Happier, probably. Then, at least, he would not have to pretend to be interested in the endless series of malfunctions brought on board his ship by Clark's 24 computers. Which raised the obvious question, why take the job at all? Alan Pryor took the job as captain of Jim Clark's boat for the same reason pretty much everyone else took the jobs Clark offered them. He thought Clark would make him rich. Clark offered 12,500 stock options in Healthscape, the company born from the Magic Diamond, with the promise of more to come. If Healthscape panned out the way Clark had said it would, Alan would make $1 million, maybe more. Alan had cut the deal cut by every captain of one of Clark's new enterprises. Endure the humiliation of not fully understanding your job, and you might just get rich. By the time Alan arrived beside the computer programmer's table, a small crowd had gathered around to see what caused the commotion in the galley. No one was sure exactly what had happened other than that Tina's table kept vanishing into the ceiling, and that it had been told to vanish by the computer. This sort of confusion was considered normal by a computer programmer, especially by a programmer of Clark's new sailboat. First, you told the machine what to do. Then the machine invariably failed to do exactly what you told it to do. And then you spent days trying to figure out why it had refused. This last stage was known as debugging, a word that entered the language back in the early 1960s, when some programmers who were having trouble with their computer found that a large moth had landed inside it and died. In the past several months, whenever Alan had asked Steve Haig how much longer it would take before he, Alan, didn't need to worry about the computer, Steve would say, "We are seeing improvement, but the boat still has bugs." Alan did not find this sort of talk reassuring. At length, Steve told Alan that he had an idea. He hadn't found the bug, but at least he knew where to look for it. Somehow the computer had been given the signal that someone wanted to watch a movie. It had responded by sealing the kitchen off from the rest of the boat. The instruction, "I want to watch a movie," was therefore obviously tied to the instruction, "Close all the doors and windows." Lance reminded Steve that at the moment Tina's table vanished into the ceiling, he was working on the boat's movie system. Alan hovered behind the programmer's table. His boat was about to cross the Atlantic Ocean, and the DVD player was throwing the boat's new lords and masters into a tizzy. The captain was meant to be up on the deck bossing people around, not down below being mystified. He leaned in and asked the obvious question.
"It couldn't happen that you'd press the button for the hot water and the mainsail would go up?" he asked. "Oh, no, no, no," said Lance. "It's just that this part of the code hasn't been tested." "Yes," said Alan. "Well, we need to make sure that everything is tested."
Alan was inching up to the question that he really wanted to ask.
"So, in the guest cabin," he finally said, "you can show the passengers the screen, but they can't do anything on it, right?"
It took a moment for Steve to realize what Alan had asked. He had asked, "Do I alone control this boat?" It was not a bad question. Everything on the boat could be controlled, at least in theory, from any of the 25 flat panel displays. Alan quite reasonably had wondered, what was to prevent a guest from punching a few buttons and, say, running the boat onto a reef? He was picturing some Silicon Valley nerd genius who'd never been on a boat reeling into his bedroom after putting away a couple of bottles of Jim Clark's fine wine and taking charge.
"No," said Steve, "we've built in different levels of access."
Actually, the programmers had created four levels of access to the computer system. The lowliest deckhand was permitted what they called Level 1 access. Level 1 access allowed the holder to turn off the deck lights, for instance. The highest level was formally called Level 4 access, and informally known by the programmers as God Mode. God Mode enabled the user to control the entire boat from any one computer screen. The good news for Alan was that only a few people had been given passwords for God Mode. Alan, Simon, the programmers, and Clark. The bad news was that the secret passwords had leaked not only to the entire crew, but also to the Dutch boatyard workers. Alan didn't want to hear any more about God Mode.
"We shut down three-quarters of the features in the guest cabin," said Steve. "The rationale is you don't want some guests waking up in the middle of the night, seeing some alarm going off,
and thinking that the ship is sinking, when all it is a refrigerator stopped running.
Alan grunted what sounded like his approval. Steve returned to the task at hand and pulled up on his screen the code that controlled the movies. Lance had written it. The audiovisual system was really the last piece of code written by Lance that had not been rewritten by someone else, usually Clark. Sure enough, the code took a typically unorthodox Lance-like approach. When you punch the button for movies on the computer screen, the computer instructed Hyperion to reconfigure itself for your viewing pleasure. The boat came alive with hums and whirs. The big screen in the main salon rose, the lights in the neighboring rooms dimmed, the shutters over the porthole shut, and the various openings leading out of the main salon into the galley below and the bridge above closed. When the boat's computers were finished, it was just you, your movie, silence, and darkness. "That's cool," someone said. "It's like a James Bond movie." Lance smiled. It was.
"Maybe if you're James Bond, it's cool," said Steve.
A bright line ran through the programmer's world, and it divided the air between Lance and Steve. On one side of the line were the aesthetes who took pleasure in the computer's complexity and spent a great deal of time writing deliciously elaborate programs that caused others to exclaim, "Cool," when they saw it, but often had no economic purpose. On the other side of the line were the utilitarians. They were interested only in the computer's crude and brutish ability to impose its will on the world around it. Lance was in love with the computer's beauty. Steve, with its power. Alan did not recognize this distinction. He simply thought of the young men from Silicon Valley as geeks who didn't belong on his boat. His strategy was to preserve at least the illusion, if not the fact, of command.
"You tell us when we can watch a movie," he said sternly, "and we'll keep an eye out for anything that moves."
For good measure, he tossed a bit of technical criticism on top of the disdain.
"I've been here a long time," he said, "and I still don't know where everything is. The dimmers for the lights, where the hell are they? Are they a computer application, or are they on a wall?"
Then he left. And for some inexplicable reason, everyone else decided the problem was more or less solved, which it wasn't. Tina glared at the programmers and said,
"If I am at the mercy of this computer, I'll be a paranoid cook."
She returned to the galley. A fog rolled in. Tim glanced up and marveled at its thickness.
Lance said, "Yeah, it looks like the inside of my brain."
Steve shot him a look.
"We haven't figured this out yet," he said.
Truth was, they were more confused than ever. The code suggested that a lot more should happen after Lance told the computer to play a movie than Tina's table vanishing into the ceiling. Lights should have dimmed, doors should have closed, shutters should have shut, and the giant movie screen should have emerged from its hiding place inside the woodwork.
"The question is, why the computer is doing this in the first place?" said Lance philosophically.
Lance was blessed with a peace-loving nature. No matter how massive the weight of public opinion against him, he refused to feel as if he was being attacked or even criticized.
"It's doing it because someone saw it on Star Trek and wanted one just like it," said Steve pointedly.
Lance ignored him. Next came the standard debugging ritual. When a computer does something unexpected, its programmers often try to provoke it into repeating the behavior. That way, they can be sure they have found the source of the problem. At Steve's insistence, Lance retyped the code he had typed 1 hour before, when Tina's table first vanished into the ceiling. Nothing happened. The table did not budge. For the next 7 minutes, the three men stared in silence into the sea-blue screens. Many computer thoughts. Finally, Steve offered a new hypothesis. It wasn't Lance's fault at all. Lance may have programmed the movie system to behave like a James Bond movie, but Lance's program did not work. All the cool stuff that Lance told the computer to do, dim the lights, raise the movie screen, close the doors and shutters, send tables into the ceilings, light a fire and pour a glass of burgundy, had failed to occur. Ergo, Tina's table should not have moved either. Lance accepted Steve's new hypothesis with the same indifference he had extended to the one before it. He knew that Steve was still guessing. So did Tim, who returned to his own terminal and asked the computer to run a complete history of itself. A computer, unlike the people who program it, can remember the experiences it has had in life. All of these experiences are electrical, of course, but the electricity is used to store information. The information contains clues to many mysteries. Some of these mysteries are even interesting. While they waited for the computer to search itself, the three young men reasoned aloud. All agreed that what Steve had just said made sense. If Lance had told the computer to play a movie on the big screen in the main salon, a lot more than Tina's table should have moved. But if someone had told the computer that he wanted to watch a movie in the galley, the computer quite possibly would have responded by merely sealing off the galley. There was no reason this could not have happened. After all, it was possible to watch a movie on any of the boat's 25 flat panel display screens. Tim and Lance and Steve followed this train of thought to what seemed to be its obvious conclusion. If someone had demanded a movie in the galley, then the problem was not caused by Lance or Steve or Tim. At the moment the computer crime was committed, all three programmers had been sitting together in the long cafeteria table in the main salon. They were each other's alibi. Steve raised his chin like a coyote preparing to howl at the moon.
Jan Boxham!
He shouted. Jan Boxham was the beleaguered Dutch fellow at the Houseman shipyard assigned by Walter Houseman to help the sailing novices from Silicon Valley gain sufficient understanding of the boat, so that they could control it. He'd quit, or threatened to, several times over the past 2.5 years. He kept saying that he knew how software should be written because he knew how Microsoft wrote software. Microsoft deployed thousands of programmers in human waves whenever it sought to create something new. Jim Clark had deployed 3 young men on top of a Jenny Craig weight loss center in Menlo Park, California. But Jan Boxham was given no choice. By edict from Walter Houseman, he and 4 or 5 other stout and sturdy Dutch workers had acquired a working knowledge of Clark's new computer system. None of them actually knew how to program the boat, but all of them knew how to use the computer. More to the point, they knew the password to gain entry to the system. Any one might have ordered a movie in the galley. Soon enough, the Dutch workers stood uneasily beside the long cafeteria table like children called before the principal.
"In the past 1.5 hours, Steve asked, "did any of you play with the touch screen in the galley?"
They shook their heads in unison. Steve looked at them for a moment as if they were political prisoners, which in a sense they were. None of the Dutchmen broke down and confessed, however, so Steve dismissed them.
"The trouble is," said Tim, after the Dutch workers had left, "they all use the same password. Anyone could have done it, and no one wants to admit it."
The young men returned to their keyboards, and for maybe 10 minutes, the only sound was of fingers typing. A few minutes later, Tim's computer spewed out the historical record. It, too, was silent on the matter of Tina's table. So far as the computer was concerned, Tina's table had levitated all by itself.
"What about a wiring problem?" asked Tim.
"Well," said Lance, "Simon has been fastidious about the cable making."
Having ceased to be the prime suspect, Lance had become more animated. He was now leaping to the defense of others. Simon was the crew member responsible for the computer hardware at sea. He'd just returned from his training course in Silicon Valley. He now worshipped the programmers, and the programmers appreciated it.
"Nah," said Steve. "Hyperion 24 received an instruction. It's just unclear where the instruction came from."
More silence. More tap-tap-tapping on keyboards. Clark turned up to see how they were coming along. Steve explained the problem with Tina's table. Clark shrugged. His attitude seemed to be that there were so many big things wrong with the software, no one should be overly concerned with small matters such as furniture vanishing into the ceiling. His unconcern acted as a narcotic on the programmers. Steve actually giggled.
"I'm not sure I'm cut out to be a manager," he said.
"It's an affliction that goes with enjoying actual work," said Clark, and returned to his computer in his cabin.
15 minutes later, Tim looked up from his keyboard and admitted the obvious.
"Well, that's unsatisfying. We have no idea why it happened. It would be nice to have closure."
Nice, but not necessary. Tim was leading them to a popular solution to an intractable computer bug. Give up. Forget about it. Hope it doesn't happen again. The boat still had dozens of bugs. What was so special about this one? The three young men breathed easier. The bug that sent Tina's table into the ceiling underwent a subtle change in status. No longer was it a problem bug, a critical bug, a meaningful bug. It was a bug that could be ignored. It could be hunted down tomorrow, or the next day, or even the next. Or maybe never. Steve snickered conspiratorially.
"It's going to be difficult to concentrate with Tina shrieking all the time,"
he said.
Tina did not quite shriek, reflected Lance. It was more of a warble.
The three young men in T-shirts and blue jeans shared a final chuckle and returned to their computers. Chapter 11. How Chickens Become Pork. It seemed at least worth asking why anyone would hand his life over to a computer program that made its own programmer uneasy. Each crew member of Hyperion had his reasons. Robert, the British engineer, hoped to be the first engineer with total command of both computers and boats. Simon, the Canadian deckhand, had fallen in love with the idea, if not the fact, of computers. Jamie, the Australian first mate, left a great job with the Japanese America's Cup Challenger for the chance to sail the boat of the future.
"This boat has an aura," he'd say. "Everyone in yachting knows about it or wants to know about it."
Tina, the American chef, simply liked Jim Clark more than anyone she'd ever worked for. She was a brilliant cook, and she knew it. And she knew Clark knew it. Clark's praise counted for a lot with her. But the larger reason Hyperion's crew agreed to cross the Atlantic Ocean on a boat run by a computer that did not seem to work very well is that already they were in so deep they really could not turn around. Clark liked to say that human beings, when they took risks, fell into one of two types, pigs or chickens.
"The difference between these two kinds of people," he'd say, "is the difference between the pig and the chicken in the ham and eggs breakfast. The chicken is interested. The pig is committed. If you are going to do anything worth doing, you need a lot of pigs."
The crew of Hyperion were now pigs for a very simple reason. They all had a stake in Clark's internet businesses. Clark couldn't stand the idea of anyone working for him without having the chance to accumulate a bit of wealth. He'd given Hyperion's crew that chance by handing them stock options in Halcyon. If the crew couldn't exactly explain the magic diamond that put Jim Clark at the center of 15% of the U.S. economy, they had heard Clark and others say that the new enterprise might one day be as big as Microsoft, and they knew that they would also get shares in the new thing, whatever that turned out to be, and that the new thing would likely be even bigger. Like a lot of people who entered Clark World, the crew of Hyperion suspected that Jim Clark would make their dreams come true. They needed only to keep his boat floating long enough for that to happen. The funny thing was that the engineers at Halcyon felt much the same way. They, too, were chickens who had been transformed into pigs, and they, too, soon found that pigs paid a surprisingly high price to play a role at Clark's breakfast table. The first bad sign came for Halcyon about 6 months after the engineers built their software for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts. The software created by Pavan's group was something of a triumph. It was secure, reliable, and worked as well for 10 million people as for 10. They had done the work of several years in 6 months, and Blue Cross Blue Shield did not want it. After saying how pleased they were with the work, Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts then announced that it could not really afford to focus on new technology. Blue Cross Blue Shield had run into financial trouble, and, as always happened in bad times, their investment in the future needed to be reduced. It fired its new technology group. For most of 1996, the engineers did what they were told by their sales force. The sales force was in turn put together by a Kleiner Perkins venture capitalist, David Schnell, who, against his better judgment, had agreed to Captain Clark's new ship. The sales force told them that the key to the magic diamond was to write the software to enable corporate employees to interact with their health plans over the Internet. They wrote this software, and no one wanted it. The sales force hired by David Schnell had led them down a blind alley.
"They had hired a bunch of perfectly nice people to sell who might as well have been selling insurance," said Stewart. "A bunch of insurance salesmen, and they didn't have a clue. Good old boys."
The good old boys were wrong. Worse than wrong. One day in late 1996, the engineers looked up and they realized that they were no longer even thinking about the magic diamond. They were doing nothing but talking to big companies about making it possible for their employees to handle all their healthcare problems over the Internet, rather than with the usual blizzard of paperwork. A worthy goal, perhaps, but nothing so grand as the original ambition of taking over the $1.5 trillion healthcare industry. In short, they realized that the business was misguided. And when they realized this, they were angry.
"At that point," said Pavan, "we engineers took over the business."
The engineers, who had always been content to act on instructions from the marketing department, did what they had never before done. They kicked the salesman to one side.
Eventually, they were all fired and went out on the road to sell their software themselves. They were looking for the keys to the magic diamond. If they found one large and important customer, they figured, others would follow. Briefly, they believed they might be hired to sort out Fidelity's healthcare plan, but that came to nothing. Fidelity would pay them $20 million to do this. Clark reappeared and told them that Netscape's first contract with MCI had only been $6 million. They were three times better than Netscape. And then in March 1997, Fidelity announced it had decided not to fiddle around with new technology after all, and the engineers found themselves without anyone who wanted to buy what they had done.
"We'd just given up our lives for 6 months," said Stewart. "My wife was pissed at me. My daughter was crying because I never came home. We worked 20-hour days, and then finally we delivered the product, and it was like, what did we just do? We gave up so much for this?"
"It was a total look inward kind of thing. We were all pretty pissed. Pav and Kitu and myself, we'd sit around having these nighttime meetings to discuss what to do, and we were all essentially yelling at one another. We'd all gotten into this fucking thing. We put our life into this fucking thing. We'd been led down a path. The period in 1996 was the most awful time in any of our lives. We knew we had created something very significant. It was just that we couldn't sell it to anybody. And what did we know? Pavin and Kitu and I, we didn't know shit. We just built what they told us to build. It was ITV all over again."
Their main fear was the main fear of every new Silicon Valley company: mass exodus. These companies could not withstand pessimism, and now there was a lot of it at Healthion. It got so bad that Pavin went to his whiteboard and drew what he called a loyalty matrix. The first 10 engineers he'd hired, he figured, were loyal to him. He called each and told them to find the people who were loyal to them, and convinced them not to quit. It only took a few people trickling out the door for the flood to begin. It was the second time in a few years a highly talented group of engineers had raced down a path Clark had put them on, and yet, oddly enough, they didn't blame Clark. It did not even occur to them to blame Clark. Through it all, they viewed Clark as their patron. Whenever the Healthion board of directors convened, the venture capitalists streamed past the engineers without saying a word. Clark stopped and spent half the day talking to them about the software. Whenever the Healthion board spoke of watering down the equity stakes that had been given to the engineers, Clark fought it. The engineers assumed that Clark was the only one in the place who stuck up for them. Instead, they blamed David Schnell, the venture capitalist who had been installed by Kleiner Perkins as temporary CEO. They told Clark, as Clark later said, that
"David occasionally left customers with the impression that the train was leaving the station, and if they didn't get on now, they would be left behind. This can be useful for a customer to feel, but it should never be explicitly said."
But of course, Schnell was the problem. Schnell was a venture capitalist, and venture capitalists normally did not need to be polite to anyone, as people usually came to them on hands and knees to plead for money. And as a venture capitalist, Schnell had the tendency, suddenly unfortunate, to make a few quick bucks rather than reshape the world in his image. He had pushed the engineers away from the magic diamond and towards this mundane little backwater called benefits administrations, where he thought they might make money immediately. And he didn't even do this well. What Clark and his engineers realized was that they needed a charismatic leader who could make the magic diamond real. What they needed was one of those guys with gray hair and soothing manners who could speak to the CEOs of large healthcare companies in their own language. One of those guys from mainstream corporate America who, instantly, by his mere presence on the scene, made the implausible plausible. What they needed, in other words, was something Jim Clark alone could never provide: a serious American executive. Until that moment of high despair in early 1997, it was never entirely clear why Clark had gone to the venture capitalists on Sand Hill Road in the first place. He didn't need their money. He had more money than all of them combined. But he did, after all, need them. He needed them to translate his extraordinary ambition into the ordinary language understood by corporate America. The man who groped for the new thing was in many ways ill-suited for mainstream business. Clark knew that the time would come to put a smiley corporate face on his ferocious ambition. He knew also that he did not know how to do this. As one longtime Clark watcher put it, "Jim is smart enough to know when he shouldn't trust himself." In particular, Clark sensed that alone he was unlikely to entice a serious American executive into running his insanely ambitious company. The serious American executive would get one long whiff of Clark world and run the other way. Premised as they were, not on profits, but on perceptions, these new Internet businesses were still all but unrecognizable to the serious American executive. A simple background check would reveal that, translated into business speak, Jim Clark meant big trouble. The venture capitalists, on the other hand, talked the talk and walked the walk. In tone and spirit, they were not all that different from serious American executives. The VCs had been to business school. They spoke the jargon. They wore the suits, or at least owned them. The VCs kept their neckties on hooks on the back of their office doors, so they could go either way. They were pleasantly free of the odor of a man on a suicide mission. One VC in particular had a gift for persuading mainstream CEOs that the only place to be was a Silicon Valley startup, John Doerr. Doerr was the only venture capitalist whom Clark favored with something akin to respect. He asked Doerr to join Healthion's board and to help him recruit a CEO. Doerr, who had told a lot of people that Healthion might one day be the biggest company Kleiner Perkins ever backed, then set out to find the serious American executive who could make the magic diamond plausible to the wider world. He found him at a conference in Phoenix, Arizona. His name was Mike Long. Long had graduated from the University of North Carolina in 1974 with a degree in history and spent the next 20 years building a nice little computer services business in Austin, Texas, called Continuum. In 1993, Continuum sold itself for $2 billion to another equally obscure computer services company called Computer Sciences. It was a big deal at the time, the seventh largest deal ever done in the computer industry. Everything about Mike Long was reassuring to Jim Clark. His gentle manner, the prematurely gray hair, his ability to appear to be in complete control. When Mike Long entered a room, everyone in it felt somehow better. He attracted followers as a magnet attracts filings. In other words, he was exactly the right man to take an inherently implausible idea and lead others to believe in it. It did not occur to Mike Long that he wanted to work in Silicon Valley until John Doerr put it to him. Over 6 months, Doerr called Long more than 100 times and talked him into leaving his stable, successful company called Computer Sciences and joining the Internet revolution. Long flew out to California to meet Jim Clark. When asked his first impressions of Clark, he'd say, "Jim's a visionary." He'd also say, "Jim's an eccentric." It took Long 6 months to extract himself from his old company. When he arrived at Healthion in July 1997, the place was in high despair. The entire company, now more than 100 people, assembled in a room. They switched off the fake waterfall so that no one missed a word. Long rose and explained how he intended to restore the company to the heart of the magic diamond. "It was clear what had happened," he later said. "This company started out with great ambitions, and then the ambition got smaller and smaller. I just took it back to Jim's original vision."
Which was exactly what the engineers wanted to hear. They did not know exactly what it was that Mike Long did, but they sensed he did it well.
"He uses all these incredible words and a way of speaking," said Stewart, though he couldn't remember any of them.
It was the engineer's way of saying that at last Healthion had found its serious American executive. The serious American executive, for his part, found chaos. At the board meeting in September 1997, Mike Long announced he was running out of money. Before the meeting, Dick Kramlich and his partners at New Enterprise Associates had valued their portfolio of investments. They'd run down a list and guess how much each company was now worth. When it came to Healthion, they wrote zero. Healthion was as good as finished, they assumed. Along with Clark, they had already put $6 million into the company, and they had no desire to put in more. And so, when Long said he needed money, the venture capitalists looked hard at the shiny conference table. Finally, they came up with a plan to raise $20 million from outside investors. Of course, if they thought Healthion had a future, they would have kept it to themselves. Since they did not, they went looking to others for capital. The exception was Clark. Clark called Long a few days after the board meeting and told him that he had thought about it and he had decided that Healthion was simply too good an opportunity to let others in on. He said he would personally provide Long with as much money as he needed. If Long needed $20 million, Clark would cut him a check for $20 million the next day. Of course, this meant that Clark would acquire an even larger stake in the company, but since the venture capitalists had valued the company at zero, he did not imagine they would object. Long called the venture capitalists with Clark's proposal. Their sense that Healthion was worth very little warred with their fear that Jim Clark knew something they did not.
Somewhere deep down, they realized how bad they would look if Healthian, by some miracle, became an enormous success, and Clark made off with it all. Almost before they knew what they had done, they threw their money on the table. $8 million. Clark supplied the other $12 million himself. That moment was a small but important turning point in Silicon Valley capitalism. Actually, that's not quite accurate. The phrase turning point suggests that there would be no backtracking when backtracking was inevitable. Still, Clark's behavior was significant. He was, for that brief curious moment, the orchestra's conductor. He set the tempo. In the past, the venture capitalists had always done that. The Silicon Valley venture capitalists had always been the first to put money into any new technology business. The internet boom had turned venture capitalism into a license to print money. Half of the investment bankers on Wall Street longed to work for NEA or Kleiner Perkins because working as a VC put you closer to the source of wealth, to the recipes. It was as if everyone at once on Wall Street realized that if you wanted the finest cut of meat, you had to muscle your way into the kitchen. Partners at Wall Street firms begged to be let in. Once you were let into the great society of Sand Hill Road, you were given first crack at these miraculous enterprises at a small fraction of the cost to Wall Street investment bankers, never mind the general investing public. But there were only a handful of people so privileged, and Kramlich and Dorr were two of the most important. Capitalism's machinery favored these capitalists as it had never favored anyone in its history. Clark jammed a wrench into this machine. He needed the venture capitalists to help him put a serious face on his precious concepts. He needed John Doerr to talk Mike Long into running the business. Other than that, so far as Clark was concerned, the finance department of the American economy was expendable. He didn't need the VC's blessing, and he certainly didn't need their money. He now sat on $1 billion of Netscape shares, and he could do whatever the hell he pleased with them. And what pleased him was to put it at great risk. The venture capitalists did not care to make these sort of colossal bets on the future. They sprinkled their money around a lot of different companies and counted on the law of averages to take care of the rest. Clark took a different approach. He said with some conviction, "I know how to make a lot of money in the future, and since I know how to make a lot of money in the future, I am going to put all my money on it." It was a difference of temperament as much as anything else. Clark had walked up to a roulette wheel surrounded by more or less reasonable men and laid all his chips on 00. And it scared the hell out of the others at the table. The venture capitalists could tolerate companies going bust. They had so many of them. But they could not tolerate missing out on the new thing. And so they poured their money in. They threw good money after bad into an enterprise they suspected would fail. They'd wanted to be chickens. Clark forced them to be pigs.
"I think Jim knew exactly what he was doing when he called Mike Long and said he would give him all the money he needed," said Dick Kramlich. "Jim has come a long way since Silicon Graphics."
Chapter 12. New Money. One summer afternoon, after a meeting with the venture capitalists about Healthian's future, Clark hopped into one of his sports cars and launched himself in the direction of San Francisco.